Good evening. My name is Peter Berg, and I'm head of special collections and the host for the Michigan Writers Series. Welcome for coming out on such a cold evening. You obviously have a wonderful group of friends and supporters. I recognize so many people from American Thought and Language. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce to you tonight F. Richard Thomas, who will read from his works. F. Richard Thomas was born in Evansville, Indiana. He attended Purdue University, the University of Minnesota, and Indiana University. Currently, he is professor of American Thought and Language at Michigan State, and editor, publisher of Years Press and Centering Magazine. His publications include six chapbooks of poems, a full-length book of poetry, Frog Praises Night, Poems with Commentary, a novel, Prism, The Journey of John Fish, and a book on the relationship of poetry to photography, Literary Admirers of Alfred Stieglitz. He is also editor of Americans in Denmark, Comparisons of the Two Cultures by Writers, Artists, and Teachers, and The Landlocked Heart, Poems from Indiana. A selection of his poetry will appear in the anthology New Poems from the Third Coast, which will be published by Wayne State University in the spring of 2000. He has received a Michigan Council for the Arts Award, a McDowell Artist Colony Fellowship, and two Fulbright Awards to teach in Denmark. He recently received a Michigan State University grant for a leave to work on an experimental novel in spring 2000. A new full-length book of his poetry will be published by Michigan State University Press in the fall of 2000. We please welcome F. Richard Thomas.
Thank you very much for coming out. Oh, I don't have to speak into this, right? This evening. I want to thank Peter Berg, too, as well, for hosting these and also the other people who have helped me this evening, as well as doing publicity, Darren Meal, for one, but also Jane Arnold and John Shaw, who have also been very helpful in getting this writer series together. I think it's a really important thing to do. I want to start with an old favorite, a humorous poem of mine. Many of you have heard this one before, but it's a good icebreaker. And it's sort of a riddle. I'll put the title up here in front and not tell you what it is. And one of my older poems, and I know that many of you have heard it before, but the title is Nick Slit Sleppmer. The epigraph for the poem is, for Carrie, four-year-old daughter, who said, let's read it backwards tonight. The dwarf sprang cursing from the ground, then smiled and danced. The queen said, Mott, kid, no, Scalridips, or Rapsack. But she finally resigned herself to stuffing her child back into her womb. Then she quit the king for a tower where the dwarf gave her a ring, a necklace, and rooms full of straw from gold. Then her father, the miller, said, straw of out goldspin, can who daughter a have I? Then they were poor and unhappy, normal. I'm going to read a variety of poems tonight, some of them older poems, some new poems. Most of them will be from Death at Camp Pahoka, which is the new book that Michigan State University is going to publish this fall. And then I'll pick up some poems from Frog Praises Night, and which was my first full-length book. And then I'll end up reading a few poems that are new poems, entirely new poems that take quite a departure, I think, from some of my earlier stuff. In between all these, I'll try to read a humorous poem every once in a while. Start with some what I would consider beginning poems. They have obviously deal with getting started or taking a first step. For me, it's getting started with writing itself, but for you, it may be something else. This first one is appropriately entitled Verge, V-E-R-G-E, Verge. And it's a very short poem. This morning comes like Spain to my house. Suddenly the sun slashes between the two houses across the field and strikes through my kitchen window, across my table, and into the sink. The goldfish is stunned in the bowl. On the orange crate, the odor of thick woods waits in the fern's leaves. My pencil is suspended above clean paper. The ocean has pushed out one bright drop that hangs from the spigot. I will move when the fish moves. Another sort of Verge poem on being of on the threshold of new possibilities. And it's titled What Opens? And the epigraph is, I love the epigraph for this poem. It goes like this. It's from Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors by Carl Sagan and Anne Druyan, his wife. Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, the line is, when the sperm cells obediently arrive in the vicinity of the calling egg, molecules on the egg's surface may cast out a kind of fishing line, hook the sperm, and reel it in. So that might even have implications for feminism, I think. So, what opens? When you arrive at the pinnacle of a mountain in Spain that overlooks the Mediterranean, you tremble where the air is thin. Your heart knocks in your throat like death, and long fingers of wind dance down the mountains from Granada, ruffle the hair on the back of the head, caress the ancient terraces, lift the hem of the sea's silk dress, and you have no choice. A door opens to yes. A tongue from the far side hooks you, reels you in. You enter, undone, transformed, possessed. Before the closed door, when the bolt slips in the catch, when the hinge sighs and a sudden inspiration, like a soft gasp, greets you at the threshold, do not resist. Pass over. The next poem is also about getting started, but here the poem is about trying to capture what comes in dreams. I'm sure anyone who's ever written, who keeps a paper and pencil beside their bed, has had this feeling. This is a very new poem. I'll read some more of the new ones later, but this seemed to fit here, so I want to read this one here. It's called Undo Her Leaving. A woman's voice hums on the edge of your dream. Listen closely. Move your hand quietly as the evening star to the bedside table. Lift the pencil. Score what she sings. The paper waits. Try to see her face before she strides away, her white bag of dark matter slung over her shoulder, bag that bangs against her backs and hips. You must copy her song. Before it breaks into dots, stems, flags exploding slowly into milky nebulae, before you see you will never hear her again, before everything you know hastens away, before nothing you do will make her turn, undo her leaving and your loneliness, right before music slips into sleep. All writers, I suppose, write about love, sex, loss, death. I'm no exception to that. I mean, that's pretty much what there is: birth, love, sex, and death, and then, of course, trying to figure out what they mean and if that's all there is. This is a lost poem, I suppose, a love lost poem. This guy has separated from his wife, and it's called Separation. This could be me, except for the fact that Sherry and I, of course, have never actually separated. But I think all married people think about it from time to time. So, Separation. It's late evening and this guy is by himself. Beery-eyed, I flip the TV off and flop on the couch in the family room. You're gone. The whole house knows. I try to read a mystery, a thing I said I had no time to do before the kids grew up. I hate mysteries. But I don't like beer either, so I get another one, flop again on the couch. Pop the top and start to tip another swig when I hear a noise in the yard. I wobble from the couch, dislodge the stick in the jam, varoom the glass door back. Nothing. Slight breeze, comfortable suburban frogs singing to each other. Some neighbor's child thinks he plays Moon River on the clarinet. The apples are the moon's moons. A tide of dew is breaking up the lawn. If I turn around, I will want to see you home in a smile of verbs and light. I press my numb nose against the screen, close my eyes, croak at the frogs, and the night goes dumb. This is a weird sort of sexy, deathy poem that I like. It's weird because the epigraph is true. It's about a flea circus, and I don't know if anybody here has been to a flea circus. Probably not. This is really true. The epigraph is, fleas are guided by the smell of blood in the breath of the flea handler. That's how their fleas are trained for a flea circus. The flea handler will blow his or her breath in front of the flea, and then the flea will hop to that blood-soaked place. And also they do tie, in flea circuses, they'll tie little tutus on to fleas and black capes and everything else. I mean, it's a pretty amazing kind of thing. So this is about a flea circus, when I found this information, I couldn't help but write this. And it's called Dominatrix of Fleas. Huddling shoulder to shoulder around the ring, we flinch in unison when the masked flea handler cracks her whip, then exhales across the tiny tightrope, thin as a spider's web. A miniature Dracula, cloaked in a tiny cape, leaps a hand's length to the other side. Dominatrix in black leather tights and bra, she lures her fleas and mesmerizes us as well. We misunderstood. This is no two-bit sideshow, but vampires, sex, and plague. We wonder if we have the nerve to leave, the will to disobey her whip, her tights, her white neck, her flesh. Her heavy breath that holds her microscopic slaves in thrall blows hot on her own faces now, makes me wince. I keep a wary eye on her, the other on the leaping fleas, then feel hard shoulders press into my arms. I wonder, did I hear a snarl or moan? I glance around to see if lips are curling back from someone's teeth. Here in the arena where I find myself with strangers dangerously bound in the bloodlust circus tent. This poem is called Two Lives, Making Supper at Lake George, and it's about Alfred Stieglitz and George O'Keefe. They had a very stormy life together and apart. Making Supper at Lake George. Lake George is Stieglitz's family compound where he took George O'Keefe and did most of the portraits in the what he calls the portrait of George O'Keefe. O'Keefe was ambivalent somewhat about Lake George as well, especially after she took off for New Mexico and fell in love with New Mexico. I mention Dorothy in here as well, and that refers to Dorothy Norman, who was Stieglitz's secretary lover as well, especially after Georgia took off for New Mexico. And she was also a photographer and a poet as well. Dorothy Norman was. Two Lives, Making Supper at Lake George. In suspenders, white silk shirt, sleeves rolled, black bow tie, Stieglitz cuts onions at the kitchen sink, lays the purple skins on a cotton towel, a tear runs into his mustache. Setting the table, O'Keefe carries plates and silver graciously, crooking her long fingers ostentatiously. Her green muslin dress falls from one shoulder. Her neck is strong. She dreams of the sun-bleached skulls of horses. He sees the dark pools of Dorothy's eyes. A sudden gust and a boom of thunder lift the lace curtain like a veil and snuff the white candle on the table. Alfred raises his eyes from the onions out the kitchen window to the boiling sky. Georgia looks up from placing a fork out the dining room window across the yard. She sees the gray slate of the lake glazed at the base of the hills like the shining silver knife in her hand. As the rain plops, a breath of ozone, wet wool, and sweet grass sprays through the window screens. Spring, the skin's thrill breaks into goosebumps on their bare arms, and their nostrils swell with the fragrance of God. The canvas edge of her calla lily flutters like a hummingbird on the easel. His cloud photos on the coffee table billow and slide and rest again in disarray. The book on the floor flips through many chapters. A thin line of smoke streams from the candle. In this light, the wine is dark as blood in the two glasses on the dining room table. Georgia lifts her shoulders together and her dress falls to the floor. Alfred slips quickly and carefully from his clothes, draping them over a dining room chair. She folds her easel and takes up her palette. He fetches his camera from the coffee table and they walk into the rain, separately. They do not look at each other for fear of bursting into flame. The screen door bangs twice, then taps and murmurs on its hinges in the storm. Well, it's time for a humor break. This is this is one called the 2023rd Psalm, and it's a satire on consumerism, and it uses as it parodies the 23rd Psalm, but this is the 2023rd Psalm. But this is instead of beginning, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," it begins like this: "The Hoover is the sweeper I really want. It maketh me to lie down with clean ashtrays. It leadeth me to like sterile quarters. It abhorreth my soil. It leadeth me down the paths of cleanliness for its namesake. Yeah. Though I walk through a hallway of filth, I will not feel queasy, for thou art with me. Thy wand and thy crevice tool, they comfort me. Thou preparest a sanitary place for me to feel good in the presence of company, but thou anointest my head with turmoil when thy bag runneth over. Surely Kirby, Bissell, Eureka, and Electrolux are good enough, but I want the brand I will follow all the days of my life, so I will dwell in the house of the Hoover forever." A sort of a follow-up to that is from Frog Praises Night. It's an old poem called Things, and it's about things, the things that we buy, we have. There are a couple things that I need to explain. I talk about my allergenic wedding band, and allergenic meaning it generates allergies, and so you could say this is somewhat autobiographical, because that's really true. I mean, I wear my wedding band every once in a while, but not very often, because my finger breaks out in a rash. Maybe it's just a cheap ring, I don't know. But talk about the allergenic wedding band. And then there's the talk about turning a coin collection to cigarettes one winter. That's also a autobiographical, semi-true story. I was saving silver quarters in a cup in the top of my chest of drawers, and they got accidentally spent on cigarettes one time by a sherry, that was. And those silver quarters were going to make me rich, too. But at any rate, they won't anymore. So this is titled Things. "Our shining white wedding Volkswagen slouches down with splayed fenders on fat, airless tires. My allergenic wedding band hides in the bottom of a drawer of a house years away. And remember, you turned my coin collection to cigarettes one winter. Their old dates, figures, faces still clink up a pillar of smoke, become bright moons in my dreams, but I can't quite grab them back. This morning, I stuffed a drooping cluster of pink and white carnations down the garbage disposal. What gives with all these things that woo our love, then fall apart or disappear? Now look, what if I held out my empty upturned hand and asked you to know the thing it holds? Could you, without seeing or touching, whatever it might be, Could you look me in the eyes and by saying nothing, say yes? Something other than a thing, at least. Well, between love, sex, birth, and death, there's everyday life. The daily life that I write about usually centers on domestic subjects that, of course, reflect my preoccupation with love, sex, birth, life, death, and all those things. Even though I'm a teacher, however, I rarely write about teaching, poems about teaching, that is. But here are a few inspired by the experiences of daily life. And the first one is called The Last Cherry Bomb. And for those of you who don't know, those of you younger people in the audience, maybe they still exist, I don't know, but I don't think so. Cherry bombs, you used to be able to get, cherry bombs in M80s. And cherry bombs were, they looked like a big cherry or a little bomb, I guess. I mean, they were, but you could blow up anything with them as a kid. I mean, they put them in a garbage can, that was the end of the neighbor's garbage can. Well, at any rate, I had saved one of these cherry bombs, and decided to set it off at some 4th of July party we had. I think it was over at Paul Summers' house one time, and this poem came out of that autobiographical event. At the backyard party, after blossoming of sparklers and bottle rockets burned bright pistols into the stars, and darkness flowed over us again like the sure course of blood to the heart, I prepared a grand Independence Day finale. I'd blow the seams off a 30-gallon garbage can, blast the lid off in a mushroom of smoke, frighten the unsuspecting kids, and deafen the other adults into a stupor of memory. The America that used to be, when M80s and cherry bombs were more fun than dangerous. Oh, sure, as kids, we'd heard of fireworks at the ballpark gone awry, but only parents knew someone who lost an eye, perhaps, or several fingers on the 4th of July. Not someone we ever knew. No, this year I'd take us back to see if we could savor what was lost. So I lit the 30-year-old sand-textured bomb and ran and waited. But all we got was a flat fup and a small white puff. My gallery burst the silence with their laughs, squeaked back and forth in aluminum lawn chairs, chortled and guffawed. Their kids looked at each other, raised their eyebrows, wondered what was funny to their crazed, aged parents. Then I laughed too, laughed at this failure of violence in the backyard of our tree-lined street in our small town, where city lights had only slightly dimmed the stars, and chirp and creak of tree frogs and crickets rolled over us like fog or sparkler smoke, while much of the cherry bombless world beyond, a fiction we barely understood, roiled like an aneurysm in the deep arteries of the night. This is also based on a real experience, and it's partially autobiographical. I think the only thing I need, it's a longish poem, which for me means it goes on to the second page. I should explain only one thing here, and that is fire balloon that I mentioned. When we were young, we used to make hot air balloons out of birthday candles and dry cleaner bags. And they actually work. You can take straws and put candles in them and get a dry cleaner bag and set the candles on fire and they'll take off. And we had the satisfaction of having them mistaken for flying saucers a couple of times in the local newspaper. So it was really quite an exciting thing to do. That's not really what the poem is about, but I just thought I should mention that to you when I come to that point. Waiting room. Is the mic okay? And everything's okay? Okay. Now's a hell of a time to ask, right? Waiting room. It isn't so much that it's Upper Sandusky. Maybe it's Sandusky. I think an Ohioan told me it was. I think maybe Dave told me that once. It isn't so much that it's Upper Sandusky. It's that I'm 2 days on the road and on my way home to Bloomington when something starts thumping in the car and I know I'll be on the shoulder waiting for a tow truck if I don't get off I-75 and head for the Ford garage. And that's where I am, in the waiting room, where two toddlers screech and whine and bang each other on the shoulders with their elbows. Their anorexic mother in Western boots, platinum hair, and tight jeans smacks the boy across the lips, then mashes her Marlboro into the ashtray. A balding stump of a woman in a coat with no buttons knits a sock and sighs, while a skinny high school dropout with missing tooth and autolite cap slices the grease from his fingernails with a pocket knife and jerks his head. A smart businessman fidgets in the doorway. He's watching TV and jangling his keys. His neck puffs over the tight collar of his shirt and tie. It's summer and hot, too, in this tiny waiting room. And I can't think straight, and I wonder if I should eat my soft and blotchy day-old peach. Through the thin wall, I hear the rattling shriek of air wrenches, but I wonder if they're working on my car. It's taking so long, and the waiting room TV is so loud. It's a soap opera on the TV, and a beautiful couple kiss and paw each other's neck and face and ears, and their hair's getting mussed. I do not believe they're from Ohio. And then in the next scene, the same man is arguing with his wife, a different woman, about their kids. She points her finger at him, and this is obviously their second or third or fourth marriage, and who knows who is the father of these kids, or if they're their kids, or if the real father's dead, or if he's maybe waiting in some greasy Ford garage, waiting for his car to be fixed and daydreaming about his former wife, or his present wife, or even his only wife, and their children, who become more and more beautiful as he waits and waits. Somehow I've got to do things differently. This heat and smell of grease and sweat, the young toothless man, the sad children, the frightened mother, the bald woman, the jangling keys, the cinched neck, the TV, this Ford garage. It's my life. It's a hole in my stomach. It's whatever it is that says, you've got to do something besides get up in the morning to eat and drive and toil and buy and drink and sleep. You've got to love your kids and wife. You've got to get out of Upper Sandusky and make love. You've got to love your life. Send up a fire balloon. Learn to work and dance again. You've got to try to touch God's finger. Your body's fine. Your mind's okay. Everybody's here. The peach you eat perfumes your neck and palms. Don't wait. Come home. I'm fascinated by the miracle that we call the body and the physical acts that I can't do that athletes can. And this poem is about watching my daughter do some impossible things while playing soccer. And it's called Soccer Match. And it's for the Michigan Hawks, which is the women's under-19 national championship team that my daughter played on. Soccer Match. Today, my daughter, you let the ball fall from an arc twice as high as our house, slide down your right thigh, knee, the birthmark on your calf, ankle, the bruise on your heel, and spurt into the open grass, the space toward which you had already moved, then somehow touched it once again to place it right before the left wing's foot, some 40 yards away. I don't know how you did this, but then I marvel at my own walking, tying my shoes, lifting a cup to my lips and setting it down, clicking the radio on and off. I think I see what this means, the miracles we are, and how miraculous to be miracles together. Unfortunately, the experience of everyday life also include illness, so I want to touch on that experience for a couple of poems. I keep forgetting I don't need this. This is an early poem from Frog Praises Night. That's not a great poem, but it gives a kind of history and jumping off poem for the poem that comes after it. There are some references to famous poems in here too, but you don't need to really know those, I don't think. Some of you who are poets might recognize them. Nobody Will Talk About My Poem is the title of it. You found a lump in your breast, then went to a pre-planned weekend conference. I went to pieces. I hung up my clothes as if for once it mattered. I bought you a half gallon of your favorite peppermint soap, then wondered if you'd last that long. I made the bed, and before I washed your dirty clothes, I held them to my nose. And then, when I could do nothing more, I, like every morbid poet, got the urge to enshrine this disaster with a poem. Poets are strange that way. You've heard their audiences after readings. Did you hear that great poem about being hosed out of the cockpit? Did you hear the one about his son who died? Wasn't that some poem? What about the one where his pet groundhog got run over by a truck? Wow. But nobody will talk about my poem, because here you are, still around, wondrously benign. And here's a poem 20 years later on the same subject. It's called Slow Dancing at the Med Inn, and the Med Inn is the hotel at the University of Michigan Hospital where family and patients can stay the night before surgery. Slow Dancing at the Med Inn. It's the night before your mastectomies. I'm sitting on the end of the bed. We got the faded orange curtain, 40-watt light bulb, green chenille bedspread room. From the shower, you suddenly loom over me, smelling of peppermint soap and wet leaves around the lake in fall. Holding a breast in each hand, as if restraining the flight of doves, you press them to my face and erupt into tears. I touch my lips to one, then the other, falter at the scent of myself, the joyful signature of my fingers and hands. I pull your body hard to mine, as if to hurt will help to heal. The room fades in and out like a bad radio. The baseboard heater tick, tick, ticks. Outside, the helicopter walloping on the roof lowers a burned child. Stars explode across the night. Volcanoes rise from the ocean floor, wobble the earth on the axis. Except for our breathing, we dare not move. This is probably maybe a natural follow-up to that poem, which is a love poem, and it's called Ascension. And the only thing I need to explain here is that lotus flowers are also sometimes known as flowers of God. So that's where it's a very short poem, Ascension, for our anniversary. Alone, I am no equal to the floating lotus, the levitating meditator, or Christ aloft. But oh, the two of us, when I regard your visionary eye, your rising forehead, the cathedral of your ear, your arching thumb, when I behold your pelvis and your collarbone like wings turn heavenward, then I rise too, with you, together twice as holy in our muscular defiance of gravity as any spiraling flower of God or any saint in his lonely ascent. Danskene here today, is it right? Aren't there some Danes here? Did they come tonight? Oh, right here, okay. Okay, I'm going to read a poem that, because I knew they were going to come, maybe they might have to participate in this as well. But this is the title of this poem. And these guys up here, if they ever meet Americans, they probably try to get them to pronounce this. Americans can't pronounce it, and I can't pronounce it either, but I'm going to read the poem anyway. Nobody can speak Danish but Danes. In fact, the unkindly Swedes say that Danish is a disease of the throat. So I suppose this fits in with the poems about the illness in that way, too. I'll pronounce the title at the end, and then they can laugh at me when I pronounce it at the end. See, none of these, the R doesn't sound like an American R, English R. The R doesn't sound like, and the D doesn't, it's soft. And the E is, you pronounce the E on the end of the FL, R-D-E. So you couldn't possibly pronounce it, and neither can I. But what it is something very nice. So that's the riddle poem, too. At any moment, I am not who I seem to be. At any moment, I am not who I seem to me. To write a poem is to walk around the self while the self is walking around. Put it this way, an urn could be glazed with my ashes, but you might look to find me inside. Sometimes when I write a poem, even I look inside, forgetting I'm not there. Like an urn, I am also whatever is or isn't at the center. I am not an urn. Things are not what they seem. If you had an urn of Wagwamefluda, you'd have strawberry soup with cream. How'd I do? Was it okay? this is in the hospital after knee surgery, waking up from codeine or Valium or any of that good stuff, Demerol. After knee surgery, I wake from codeine dreams and feel a smooth leg against my inner thigh. How wonderful, I think, that even St. Mary's condones a conjugal visit. Or better yet, perhaps some new nurse-patient post-knife therapy. But when I turn to put my arm around a waist, there's no one there. And when I lay my hand upon the disembodied thigh, I find it's me, my prepped and sexy hairless leg I've fallen for. Suddenly I understand transvestites, transsexuals, lesbians. To make love to a hairy man must be like squirming in wool pants in a hot and sticky church pew. I gave up religion for that reason. Must I now relinquish manhood too? Oh, surgeon, woolly Satan, bring back the knife and prep me head to toe. I want to love me everywhere. I'm going to read a few new poems now. That very new poems. And if you find any problems with them, you can blame Leonora and Jay because they didn't give me a good enough workshop on them. I think these poems are influenced by my reading of several poets. So for one, I've always been interested in Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons, even though I never really liked them very much. And then not too long ago, I started reading books in the library here by Russell Edson, who writes interesting sort of dreamlike poems that are sometimes very powerful. And while at the same time I was reading him, I was reading Zbigniew Herbert's, actually it was Czesław Miłosz's translation of Zbigniew Herbert, selected poems, and was sort of fascinated by the form. And these are called Dreaming Wide Awake Poems. Because they really what they are is poems that I sort of dream while I'm awake. And I suppose it's kind of like daydreaming on paper, but it's somehow a little bit different. So this one is called Lunar Ear. There are a few in this group, and then I'm getting close to being finished here. These are fairly short poems. The first one is called Lunar Ear, and I should explain pigment floaters. Pigment floaters are those of you who every once in a while you'll see this thing float across your eye and it goes off someplace and you think it's somebody there. Well, that's a floater. Okay, it's called a pigment that breaks off in your eye and floats around. A lot of people have pigment floaters. It's also an early indicator of glaucoma as well. So if any of you do have those, you should probably get your eyes checked for glaucoma. But this is called Lunar Ear. On that side of evening, our voices floated like puffs of milkweed across the lawn. Light of the galactic moons angled through the apple orchard's branches, silvering our shoes, toes, and the backs and arms of the white metal lawn chairs. Down the yard, rusted cars, broken bicycles, a ruined Harley lay in half light, dark at their roots where they pressed the earth for so long. In the meadow, beyond the black catenary of barbed wire, brilliant sheep lowered their mouths to the dewy grass. Why, with these stars, these moons, we decided to descend into the underground passage at the end of the long driveway is not clear. One moon shone when we peered back up the barrel of the tunnel, but soon that too disappeared like a camera shutter's click, leaving us alone and sightless in the silence, milkweed seeds blossoming in our heads like pigment floaters that draw the eyes one way, then another, as if they could track the eruptions of the night. This one's an illuminated scrapbook. A friend of mine in the math department, Dick Phillips, died recently, and it was thinking about his death and loss that got me started on this poem. Here, however, in this poem, it's clearly a lover who is missed. It's called Illuminated Scrapbook. Illuminated manuscripts, which is, of course, where it's taken from, were 13th, 14th century hand-painted Bibles that had gold lettering on each page, and that's how each page was illuminated. It had the light of God by the gold lettering on gold mixed in egg whites. So this is a modern illuminated manuscript, and it's called Illuminated Scrapbook. A string marks the page, tells me where I am, where I want to be, reading you as if you were here, and almost you are, at the photo glossy yellowing edge, your breath almost on my neck, in my hair, but not you, not textured bristling skin of desire, not you who's deep and mind enough to call upon me from the dead, to see me see you here, hear you hear me now, thumbing to this page again, summing this page to this gold string, this grief again. I screwed up the last line on that. Free. Say walking under green trees of summer, a golden wind startled your face and neck pale. Say grasping the reins of a blue horse, you cantered aimlessly on a lake. Or say you found yourself writing with a pen that exhaled, inhaled words, sentences with every gesture, every stroke. Or say there never were such times, such places. Say instead you do not dream, never dreamed, decided not to dream. So then say you know no joy, nor fear, nor what to try to know, nor how, but live in peace, comfort, drugged or not drugged, but free, say, of blue horses, golden winds, pens that breathe inscrutable ink, the cosmic wonderland, the mind that dives in space to fetch a light, a prayer, a cure, a song, a word or wing that flies. I'll read two more, one short one and then one. One more new one. This is the last of the new ones, called Rainbow. Imagine yourself stuck in the middle of a rainbow. I don't know which way to turn, stuck here in green, the middle bow. Green from head to toenails. We're all so boring here, insignificant alike, so green. Oh, when I pray, my breath hollows out little clear balloons in this chlorophyllophiliac's expanse, but it's useless in this endlessness. With all my prayers to the pot of God at the end of the bow, you're still over there in blue, and all we want to do is get ahead, move to yellow, and then together, head for red. That's not an MSU poem, or somebody said they thought it was, and I guess it could be that. So. One last poem, and that's called Death at Camp Ahoka, which is the title of the book that Michigan State's going to publish. And the epigraph here is reads, "It is choice that decides which of the quantum worlds we measure in our experiments, and therefore which one we inhabit." That's a quote from John Gribben, the scientist. There's an experience of feeling that you've died and wakened into an entirely different life, or a different universe even, in this poem. And in that sense, it's somewhat autobiographical. It's taken from an autobiographical event in my life. Along this idea is choice that decides which of the quantum worlds we measure in our experiments, and therefore which one we inhabit. I don't know if you saw last week, was it a week or two ago, that a newspaper article said that scientists had now been able to make atoms be in two different places at the same time. So, Death at Camp Ahoka. Kitchen crew, rinse boy, I dipped each plate into the large stone sink of hot water till garbage floated inches deep. Under the surface, my hand seemed to slither through intestines and the tails of dead rats. One evening after mess, nauseated by the steaming tubs of slime, I staggered to my tent, doubling over in the pine grove, holding my gut until I collapsed on my cot. The last I remember is the smell of tarp, Sweat trickling in the air, hair around my ears, the whine of cicadas, a centipede crawling across the shadows of leaves that lay scarcely moving on the yellow canvas roof. I'm sure I died that day and woke into a different world, a different kitchen, where the kid who scraped the plates before I rinsed said he, like me, had never been away from home. Though slop still filled the sink, the pine grove stood more green and stars more brilliant above the mess hall. I wonder if an in memoriam plaque now hangs above that other sink. One more Boy Scout, first class, rinse boy, killed by swill. But even more, I wonder how I knew to choose this universe, this charmed one, this one with this daughter to whom I pass each dish to dry, who gives it to my son to put away, then snaps his butt with her towel, this wife who wipes the table clean, this life. Thank you.